A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel wrote to us. He's been thinking about a social engineering technique he's used himself, playing dumb in situations where the other side isn't playing fair, specifically landlord-tenant stuff. He's got a law degree, but when his landlord refused to fix a roof leak, he leaned into his Irish accent and played the clueless tenant who doesn't understand any of this legal stuff. The strategy is simple. Let powerful people feel like they're winning, document everything, and let them dig their own grave. He's asking, does this technique have a name, and how can people use it when they're up against someone who holds all the cards?
It does have a name, and Daniel's absolutely right. It's one of the most effective social engineering plays in the book, precisely because it exploits something the powerful almost never see coming. That the person they're dealing with might be smarter than they are. The landlord who thinks he's explaining basic lease terms to a confused Irish tenant isn't going to guard his words. He's going to say things he'd never put in writing if he thought a lawyer might read them. And that's the whole game.
The technique isn't really about being dumb. It's about being underestimated.
And that distinction matters because it tells you what the technique actually is. A deliberate performance of confusion or naivety designed to lower someone's guard and encourage overconfidence. You're not lying about facts, you're not forging documents, you're not breaking any laws, you're just letting someone's own arrogance do the work for you.
Which is a kind of judo, isn't it? You're using their weight against them.
That's the perfect metaphor. And with rental markets tightening globally, we're seeing vacancy rates drop in pretty much every major city. The power imbalance between landlords and tenants is getting worse, not better. Most tenants don't have the money for a lawyer. They don't know their rights. They don't know how to research case law the way Daniel can, so they need tools that work without requiring institutional authority. Strategic incompetence is one of those tools.
It's also deeply satisfying to picture a slumlord confidently explaining why he doesn't have to fix a leak, completely unaware that every word is being documented and timestamped.
There's a poetic justice to it, but let's be clear about what we're actually talking about here. This isn't just a clever trick. It's a psychological strategy with real research behind it, and it works because it exploits specific, well-documented biases in how people think.
Walk me through those. What's actually happening in someone's head when they fall for this?
There are three mechanisms, and they stack on top of each other. The first one is the overconfidence effect, and this is one of the most robust findings in behavioral psychology. When people believe they're dealing with someone less capable than themselves, they become less cautious. They stop checking their own reasoning. They reveal strategy. They make mistakes. They say things out loud that they'd normally keep to themselves. A 2023 study in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology found something fascinating. Participants who were perceived as less competent were actually trusted with more sensitive information. Not because they seemed trustworthy, but because they seemed less threatening. The target thinks, this person couldn't possibly use this against me, so I don't need to be careful.
The landlord who thinks he's talking to someone who doesn't understand leases is going to explain things he'd never explained to a lawyer. He's going to spell out exactly how he's breaking the law, because in his head, the person he's talking to can't do anything with that information.
And that connects to the second mechanism, the halo effect of perceived power. Powerful people expect deference. It's not even conscious most of the time. When you've spent years being the person who owns the property and makes the rules, you develop this assumption that tenants will be grateful, confused, compliant. Strategic incompetence feeds that expectation. You're giving them exactly what they expect to see. Someone who doesn't understand, someone who needs things explained, someone who isn't a threat. And because you're confirming their worldview, they relax. They feel in control. And that's exactly when they walk into the trap.
It's almost like you're giving them a sedative.
You're drugging their threat detection. And the third mechanism is the one that I think is most elegant, cognitive load shifting. When you appear confused and ask someone to explain something, you're forcing them into teaching mode. teaching mode is fundamentally different from adversarial mode. In adversarial mode, someone is guarded, they're thinking about what not to say, they're calculating. In teaching mode, they're focused on being clear and helpful. Their defenses drop. And here's the key, they're doing all the cognitive work. You're just sitting there nodding, occasionally saying, "I'm sorry, could you explain that part again?" while they exhaust themselves explaining things and, in the process, say things they absolutely should not be saying to someone who might use it against them.
You're basically outsourcing the labor of building your case to the person you're building it against.
And that's why this technique is so powerful when you're the underdog. You don't have resources, you don't have a legal team. But you have patience, and you have the ability to look confused, and that's enough to get the other side to do the work for you.
Daniel mentioned that being Irish helps. The cultural stereotype of Irish people as friendly, good-natured, non-confrontational, it makes the performance more believable because people already expect him to be harmless.
That's a real factor, and it's worth naming. Every culture has stereotypes that can be weaponized this way. The trick is to understand what stereotype the other person is likely to apply to you and lean into the harmless version of it. If you're young, you can lean into, "I'm new to all this." If you're older, you can lean into, "I'm not good with technology," or, "I don't understand how things work these days." If you have an accent, you can lean into, "I'm not from here, I don't know the system." The key is to find the version of yourself that the other person already expects to see and give it to them.
There's a line, isn't there? Between performing confusion and actively lying?
There is, and this is where the ethics get real. The distinction that matters is between performing a lack of understanding and misrepresenting facts. If you say, "I don't understand how the security deposit rules work," that's a performance of confusion. It's not a false statement. You might understand perfectly well, but you're not claiming to know something false. You're just not displaying your knowledge. The line blurs when you say, "I've never read the lease," if you actually have, or, "I don't know what the law says," if you've researched it extensively. At that point, you're making a false statement of fact, and that crosses into deception.
The safe version is to ask questions rather than make claims.
"Could you explain how the security deposit works?" is a question. It doesn't assert anything about what you do or don't know. "I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. Are you saying you're keeping the deposit because of the carpet stain? That's a clarification request. You're not lying. You're just not volunteering that you already know the answer, and you're recording the response."
The documentation piece is non-negotiable.
Without documentation, strategic incompetence is just a performance with no payoff. Every "I don't understand" has to be followed by a time-stamped record of what was said. Otherwise, you've just let someone explain things to you for no reason. Daniel mentioned this explicitly. He was careful to document everything while playing clueless. That's the discipline. The performance creates the opening, but the documentation is what wins the case.
There's historical precedent for this, isn't there? This isn't a new idea.
It goes back at least to Sun Tzu. The Art of War has that famous line, "When you are weak, appear strong. When you are strong, appear weak." The inverse application is exactly what we're talking about. Appearing weak when you are actually prepared. Feigning vulnerability to draw an enemy into overextension. Sun Tzu called it playing dead. You convince the opponent they've already won, and while they're celebrating, you strike.
Which is basically what Daniel did. He let the landlord think he'd won, that this clueless Irish tenant wasn't going to fight back, and by the time the landlord realized what was happening, there was a paper trail.
There's a modern case study that illustrates this perfectly. A tenant in New York used what we're calling the confused email technique. They sent polite, seemingly naive emails asking the landlord to clarify why their security deposit was being withheld. The landlord, feeling completely in control, wrote back explaining that the deductions were for normal wear and tear. That phrase, "normal wear and tear," is the exact language that New York General Obligations Law 7-108 says cannot be the basis for withholding a deposit. The landlord admitted to breaking the law in writing, in their own words, because they thought they were explaining something to someone who wouldn't know the difference. The tenant won triple damages.
Triple damages because the landlord was so confident they put their own violation in writing.
That's the judo throw. And the landlord never saw it coming because the tenant never signaled that they knew anything. The performance was consistent from start to finish.
Let's talk about what makes the performance work. Because I think a lot of people hear this and think, "I'm not a good actor. I can't pull this off."
That's actually one of the biggest misconceptions about this technique. People think you need to be naturally charismatic or a good liar. You don't. The performance is low stakes because you're not pretending to be someone else. You're just exaggerating a natural reaction that most people genuinely experience in unfamiliar situations. Almost everyone has been confused by a lease. Almost everyone has felt overwhelmed by legal language. You're not inventing a character. You're just turning up the volume on a real feeling and not correcting it when the other person assumes you don't understand.
It's more about restraint than performance, not showing what you know.
The hardest part isn't acting confused. It's not jumping in to correct someone when they say something wrong. That impulse to show competence, to demonstrate that you're smart and you understand, that's what you have to suppress. And that's hard for a lot of people, especially people who've been underestimated their whole lives. The urge to prove yourself is powerful. But in this scenario, proving yourself is exactly what loses you the advantage.
The discipline is silence.
The discipline is letting someone be wrong about you, letting them think you're less than you are. That's uncomfortable, but it's also what makes the technique work.
What about when it backfires? Because I can imagine a scenario where the other person isn't fooled, and now you've just made yourself look weak for no reason.
That's the risk, and you have to know the signs. If the other party starts documenting you, if they suddenly become very formal, if they start CCing people on emails, if they bring in a third party, they've probably recognized the performance and they're escalating. At that point, you drop the act immediately and pivot to direct confrontation. The technique is a scalpel, not a hammer. You use it while it works, and you abandon it the moment it stops working.
There's also the question of who you use it against. Daniel was dealing with a slumlord who refused to fix a roof leak. That's a clear case of an asymmetric power dynamic where the powerful party is acting in bad faith. But you wouldn't use this against, say, a small landlord who's trying to do the right thing and just made a mistake.
No, and that's the ethical boundary that matters most. The technique is a shield, not a sword. It's for leveling an uneven playing field, not for exploiting someone who's also vulnerable. If you're using strategic incompetence against a corporation or a slumlord who's clearly acting in bad faith, that's defensive. If you're using it against an individual who's acting in good faith and just doesn't have the same resources you do, that's predatory. The power differential is what determines whether this is ethical or not.
Before you deploy this, you ask yourself, am I protecting myself or am I exploiting someone else?
That's the question. And if the honest answer is the second one, don't do it.
Let's get practical. Daniel asked how people can actually use this. What does it look like in practice?
There are three concrete techniques that anyone can use, and they all build on the same principle. The first is the confused email. You write something like, I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. Are you saying you won't fix the leak because it's not legally required? Could you point me to the section of the lease that says that? You already know the answer. You already know the lease probably doesn't say that. But you're forcing them to either put their bad faith position in writing or back down. Either way, you win.
If they put it in writing, you've got evidence. If they back down, the leak gets fixed.
The second technique is the help me understand phone call. This one requires you to know your local recording laws. 38 U.S. states are one-party consent, meaning you can record a conversation you're part of without telling the other person. 11 states require all-party consent. In the UK and Israel, recording without consent is generally illegal unless you're a participant, but the rules vary. Know your jurisdiction before you do this. But assuming you're in a place where you can legally record, you call and you say things like, I'm just trying to understand why the repair hasn't been scheduled, and could you walk me through the timeline again? And you let them talk. You don't argue. You don't correct. You just ask questions and let them explain themselves into admitting liability or revealing bad faith.
The third technique?
The I'll just check with someone delay. This one is useful when you're caught off guard. Someone makes a demand or a claim, and instead of responding immediately, you say something like, I'm sorry, I don't really understand this stuff. Let me check with someone who knows more and get back to you. It buys you time to research, to prepare counterarguments, and to come back with a response that's framed as someone explained it to me. It lets you be sharp without breaking character, because you're attributing the sharpness to someone else.
You get to be both the confused tenant and the well-informed tenant, just in sequence rather than at the same time.
The sequence is what protects the performance. By the time you come back with researched counterarguments, the other person has already categorized you as harmless. They're not going to suddenly reevaluate you as a threat just because you came back with good questions. They'll assume someone else fed you the questions. The illusion holds.
Which brings us back to Daniel's situation. He had a law degree, but played clueless, documented everything, and let the landlord dig his own grave. The technique worked because he was disciplined about staying in character, and meticulous about gathering evidence.
Because he understood something that a lot of people miss. The goal isn't to win the argument. The goal is to win the case. You don't need to convince the landlord they're wrong. You don't need them to admit fault in the moment. You just need them to say enough incriminating things on the record that a judge or a regulator can see what happened. The landlord can walk away from the conversation feeling like they won, feeling smug, feeling superior. And 6 months later, they're writing a check for triple damages because they were so busy feeling superior that they didn't notice they were building the case against themselves.
There's something almost Columbo about it. The detective who shuffles in looking confused asks one more thing and lets the suspect talk themselves into a corner.
That's exactly the reference. Columbo's entire technique was strategic incompetence. He looked rumpled and confused and harmless, and suspects consistently underestimated him while he gathered evidence. Peter Falk played it perfectly, the bumbling questions that turned out to be surgical. And the suspects never saw it coming because they were too busy feeling superior.
What Daniel's really asking us to do is teach people how to be Columbo.
In a landlord-tenant dispute, yes. And in any situation where the power differential is structural and the other side isn't playing fair. Know your rights cold, document everything, ask innocent questions, and let the other person's arrogance do the heavy lifting.
Before we get into the practical playbook, and we will, let's name something. This technique works because most powerful people have a blind spot. They assume that people who seem confused actually are confused. They assume that people who don't display competence don't have it. And that assumption is a vulnerability that anyone can exploit.
It's the arrogance tax, and Daniel figured out how to collect it. That's really what Daniel's question is about. Not just a clever trick, but a way of navigating a relationship that's structurally rigged. The landlord-tenant dynamic is one of those rare situations where one party holds almost all the cards. Property, capital, legal experience, access to lawyers. The landlord has all of it. The tenant has vulnerability and need. That's not a moral judgment, it's just the structure.
The structure means that playing fair doesn't always work, because the game itself isn't fair.
If you're a tenant dealing with a landlord who knows the law and knows you probably don't, simply asking nicely for a repair puts you in a position of hoping they'll be decent. Strategic incompetence flips that. It says, I'm not going to hope you're decent. I'm going to use your assumption that I'm helpless to make you show your hand.
The performance of confusion is really a kind of trap. You're not actually confused. You're creating a situation where the other person feels so safe that they stop filtering.
That's the definition. Strategic incompetence is the deliberate performance of naivety or confusion to lower a target's guard and encourage overconfidence. The word deliberate matters. This isn't accidental. It's not genuine helplessness. It's a choice to withhold your competence because displaying it would make the other person more careful, and you don't want that.
Which is counterintuitive for most people. The instinct is to show you're smart, to demonstrate you can't be pushed around. This technique says the opposite. Let them think they can push you around, and document them doing it.
To understand why this works so well, we need to look at the psychology underneath it. There are three mechanisms that stack on top of each other, and the first one is the overconfidence effect. This is one of the most replicated findings in behavioral psychology. When people believe they're dealing with someone less capable, their guard drops. They stop checking their own reasoning. They say things out loud they'd normally keep to themselves.
Because in their head, the person across from them can't do anything with the information anyway.
And there's a 2023 study in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology that found something remarkable. Participants who were perceived as less competent were actually trusted with more sensitive information, not because they seemed honest or reliable, but because they seemed less threatening. The target's internal calculation is basically, this person couldn't possibly use this against me, so why would I bother being careful?
The landlord explaining his deposit policy to someone he thinks is clueless is going to spell out things he'd never say to a lawyer. He's going to describe exactly how he's breaking the law, because the person he's describing it to doesn't register as a threat.
That's the mechanism, and it connects directly to the second one, the halo effect of perceived power. Powerful people expect deference. It's not even conscious most of the time. When you spent years being the person who owns the property and sets the terms, you develop this assumption that tenants will be grateful, confused, compliant. Strategic incompetence feeds that expectation perfectly. You're giving them exactly what they expect to see. Someone who doesn't understand, someone who needs things explained, someone who isn't a threat. And because you're confirming their worldview, they relax. They feel in control. And that's precisely when they walk into the trap.
It's almost pharmacological. You're sedating their threat detection.
And the third mechanism is the one I find most elegant, cognitive load shifting. When you appear confused and ask someone to explain something, you force them into teaching mode. Teaching mode is fundamentally different from adversarial mode. In adversarial mode, someone is guarded, calculating, thinking about what not to say. In teaching mode, they're focused on being clear and helpful. Their defenses drop. And here's the key, they're doing all the cognitive work. You're just sitting there nodding, occasionally saying, "I'm sorry, could you explain that part again?" While they exhaust themselves explaining things and, in the process, say things they absolutely should not be putting on the record.
You're outsourcing the labor of building your case to the person you're building it against.
And that's why this technique is so powerful when you're the underdog. You don't have resources. You don't have a legal team. But you have patience, and you have the ability to look confused, and that's enough to get the other side to do the work for you.
Sun Tzu basically wrote the playbook for this, didn't he?
The Art of War has that line, "When you are weak, appear strong. When you are strong, appear weak." The inverse application is exactly what we're describing, appearing weak when you are actually prepared, feigning vulnerability to draw an enemy into overextension. Sun Tzu called it playing dead. You convince the opponent they've already won, and while they're celebrating, you strike.
Which is precisely Daniel's landlord scenario. Let the guy feel victorious, let him think he's dealing with a confused tenant who won't fight back, and by the time he realizes what's happening, there's a paper trail.
That brings us to the thing that makes or breaks the entire strategy, documentation. Without it, strategic incompetence is just performance art. Every "I don't understand" has to be followed by a timestamp record of what was said. Otherwise, you've just let someone explain things to you for no reason. Daniel was explicit about this. He was careful to document everything while playing clueless. That's the discipline. The performance creates the opening, but the documentation is what wins the case.
There's a corporate version of this too, isn't there? The junior employee who doesn't understand why a policy exists.
A junior employee sends an email saying, "I'm sorry, I'm just trying to understand. Why do we handle expense approvals this way? It seems like there's a gap between what the policy says and what actually happens." The manager, feeling helpful and dealing with someone they perceive as naive, writes back explaining exactly how they exploit the loophole, in an email, which now exists forever. The employee wasn't confused, they'd spotted the problem weeks ago. But asking the question got the manager to document their own bad behavior in writing.
The manager never saw it coming because the employee never signaled competence.
Because the employee understood the core insight here. The goal isn't to win the argument. The goal is to win the case. You don't need to convince the other person they're wrong in the moment. You just need them to say enough incriminating things on the record that a judge, a regulator, or HR can see what happened. They can walk away from the conversation feeling smug, feeling superior. And 6 months later, they're writing a check or cleaning out their desk because they were so busy feeling superior that they didn't notice they were building the case against themselves.
The arrogance stacks. We've established this works, but I want to sit with the ethics for a minute because I think there's a line here that's easy to stumble across without noticing.
There is, and it's worth being precise about it. The distinction that matters is between performing a lack of understanding and actively misrepresenting facts. If you say, "I don't understand how the security deposit rules work," that's a performance of confusion. You might understand perfectly well, but you're not making a false claim. You're just not displaying your knowledge. The line blurs when you say, "I've never read the lease," if you actually have, or "I don't know what the law says," if you've researched it extensively. At that point, you're making a false statement of fact, and that crosses into deception.
The safe version is to ask questions rather than make claims.
"Could you explain how the security deposit works?" is a question. it doesn't assert anything about what you do or don't know. I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. Are you saying you're keeping the deposit because of the carpet stain? That's a clarification request. You're not lying. You're just not volunteering that you already know the answer, and you're recording the response.
The other ethical boundary is who you're using it against. Daniel was dealing with a slumlord who refused to fix a roof leak. Clear bad faith. Clear power imbalance. But you wouldn't deploy this against a small landlord who's trying and just made an honest mistake.
No, and that distinction is everything. The technique is a shield, not a sword. If you're using it against a corporation or a slumlord who's clearly acting in bad faith, that's defensive. If you're using it against an individual who's acting in good faith and just doesn't have the same resources you do, that's predatory. The power differential is what determines whether this is ethical or not.
Before you deploy, you ask yourself, am I protecting myself, or am I exploiting someone else?
That's the question. And if the honest answer is the second one, don't do it.
Let's get concrete then. Daniel asked how people can actually pull this off. What does it look like in practice?
Three techniques, and they all build on the same principle. The first is the confused email. You write something like, I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. Are you saying you won't fix the leak because it's not legally required? Could you point me to the section of the lease that says that? You already know the lease probably doesn't say that, but you're forcing them to either put their bad faith position in writing or back down. Either way, you win.
If they put it in writing, you've got evidence. If they back down, the leak gets fixed.
The second technique is the help me understand phone call. This one requires you to know your local recording laws. 38 U.S. states are one-party consent, meaning you can record a conversation you're part of without telling the other person. 11 states require all-party consent. In the UK and Israel, recording without consent is generally illegal unless you're a participant, but the rules vary by jurisdiction. Know yours before you do this. But assuming you're in a place where you can legally record, you call and say things like, I'm just trying to understand why the repair hasn't been scheduled, and could you walk me through the timeline again? And you let them talk. You don't argue. You don't correct. You just ask questions and let them explain themselves into admitting liability or revealing bad faith. The I'll just check with someone delay. This one is useful when you're caught off guard. Someone makes a demand or a claim, and instead of responding immediately, you say something like, I'm sorry, I don't really understand this stuff. Let me check with someone who knows more and get back to you. It buys you time to research. To prepare counterarguments, and to come back with a response framed as someone explained it to me. It lets you be sharp without breaking character because you're attributing the sharpness to someone else.
You get to be both the confused tenant and the well-informed tenant, just in sequence rather than at the same time.
The sequence protects the performance. By the time you come back with research counterarguments, the other person has already categorized you as harmless. They're not going to suddenly reevaluate you as a threat just because you came back with good questions. They'll assume someone else fed you the questions. The illusion holds.
Daniel mentioned his Irish identity as part of what made this work for him. How much does that matter?
It's a real asset, but it's not the only one. Cultural stereotypes of Irish people as friendly, unserious, non-confrontational, that makes the performance more believable because the target already expects harmlessness. But the technique works with any identity that carries a harmless stereotype. If you're young, you can lean into, I'm new to all this. If you're older, you can lean into, I'm not good with technology, or I don't understand how things work these days. If you have an accent, you can lean into, I'm not from here, I don't know the system. The key is to find the version of yourself that the other person already expects to see and give it to them.
What about when it backfires? Because I can imagine a scenario where the other person isn't fooled, and now you've just made yourself look weak for no reason.
That's the risk. And you have to know the signs. If the other party starts documenting you, if they suddenly become very formal, if they start CCing people on emails, if they bring in a third party, they've probably recognized the performance and they're escalating. At that point, you drop the act immediately and pivot to direct confrontation. The technique is a scalpel, not a hammer. You use it while it works and you abandon it the moment it stops working.
The New York case you mentioned earlier, the tenant who caught triple damages. That's the model, isn't it?
That's the template. A tenant in New York sent polite, seemingly naive emails asking the landlord to clarify why their security deposit was being withheld. The landlord, feeling completely in control, wrote back explaining that the deductions were for normal wear and tear. That phrase is the exact language that New York General Obligations Law 7-108 says cannot be the basis for withholding a deposit. The landlord admitted to breaking the law in writing, in their own words, because they thought they were explaining something to someone who wouldn't know the difference.
The landlord basically served themselves.
That's the judo throw at its purest. The tenant never signaled competence. The performance was consistent from start to finish. The landlord walked away from every interaction feeling like the smartest person in the room, right up until the judgment landed.
If someone's listening to this and thinking, I need this in my life, where do they actually start? Not the performance.
Step one is knowing your legal rights cold. And I mean cold. The performance only works if you actually understand the underlying law. You can't strategically withhold knowledge you don't have. So before you send a single confused email, research your jurisdiction's tenant protections. What are the repair obligations? What are the timelines? What are the penalties for non-compliance? What's the security deposit law? How many days do they have to return it? What can they deduct for? What are the damages if they violate it?
Because the whole strategy hinges on knowing exactly what you're trying to get the other person to say. You're not fishing randomly. You're guiding them toward admitting a specific legal violation.
And you also need to know your recording consent laws before you pick up the phone. 38 states are one-party consent, 11 are all-party. In Israel and the UK, it's more restrictive. If you're not sure, stick to email. Email is inherently documented, it's time-stamped, and you don't need anyone's permission to keep it.
Which brings us to step two. Build the documentation habit. Every interaction should produce a record.
It doesn't need to be complicated. A dedicated email folder. A voice memo app if you're in a one-party consent jurisdiction. Even a notebook with dated entries. July 1st, called landlord, said roof repair, not his responsibility, cited section 4 of lease which doesn't mention roofs. That kind of contemporaneous note carries weight if it ever ends up in front of a judge. The key is time-stamped, consistent, and specific.
Step 3 is knowing when to drop the act. You said earlier this is a scalpel, not a hammer. What are the signals?
If the other party starts CCing a lawyer. If their tone shifts from casual to formal. If they start documenting you, suddenly everything is per our conversation, and as stated in my previous email. That's someone who's recognized the game and is building their own record. At that point, you pivot. Drop the confused act and switch to direct, clear, legally informed communication. You've already got whatever evidence you gathered during the performance phase. Now you protect yourself by showing you're not an easy target.
Step 4 is the one I think people will skip because it feels silly. Practice the tone.
It's not silly at all. The performance has to be consistent. One moment of sharp legal knowledge, one sentence where you accidentally cite the relevant statute, and the illusion shatters. The other person recalibrates. They realize you're not harmless. And suddenly they're guarded, careful, lawyering up, so practice with a friend. Have them role-play the landlord and call out anything that sounds too informed. The goal is to sound like someone who's confused and a little overwhelmed, not like someone who's pretending.
The friend can also help you practice the hardest part, not jumping in to correct someone when they say something wrong. That impulse to prove you're smart is the thing that kills the technique.
It really is. The whole strategy rests on letting someone be wrong about you. And that takes practice, because it goes against every instinct most people have. But once you've done it a few times, it becomes second nature. You realize that silence isn't weakness, it's patience. And patience is what lets the other person walk themselves right into the trap they built. There's one question that sits underneath all of this, though. How long does the technique actually have? We're in a moment where awareness of manipulation tactics is spreading fast. True crime podcasts, social engineering explainers, Reddit threads where people dissect every interaction for hidden agendas. At some point, the landlord has heard the same podcast we're making.
The arms race problem. Strategic incompetence works because it exploits a blind spot. But once enough people know about the blind spot, it's not blind anymore.
And I think we're already seeing the early stages of a counter-tactic evolution. Landlords who've been burned once start documenting everything from the first interaction. They use formal language in every email. They refuse phone calls and insist on written communication only. They bring in property managers as buffers. Those are all defenses against exactly this kind of technique.
The window might be closing.
I don't think it closes completely, but I think it narrows. The technique evolves rather than dies. The version that worked 5 years ago, the wide-eyed, "I don't understand any of this," might get flagged faster now. But the next iteration might be subtler. Less performative confusion, more selective silence. Letting someone's assumptions do the work without actively feeding them.
There's the AI angle. We're already seeing sentiment analysis tools that can scan communication patterns and flag anomalies. A landlord with the right software could theoretically detect when a tenant's emails shift from confused to strategically confused. The vocabulary patterns, the question structures, the timing.
That's not science fiction anymore. Large language models can analyze tone and consistency across an email thread. If a tenant sends 6 emails that all read as naive and then suddenly produces a legally sophisticated demand letter, an AI tool could flag that inconsistency. The landlord doesn't even need to be smart. The software does the pattern matching.
Which means the technique has to get better. The performance has to be more consistent, more gradual. You can't go from what's a lease to citing case law in one jump. The evolution has to be invisible.
That's actually a higher bar than most people are prepared for. It requires real discipline over weeks or months. But it also means the people who master it will be even more effective, because the targets who rely on AI screening will have false confidence in their tools.
The arms race continues. But I want to land on something more fundamental before we close. Daniel's question was about a technique, but what he was really describing was a way of navigating power. And the most ethical version of this, the version we've been describing, is always going to be the version where the powerless use it against the powerful, not the other way around.
That's the line. And it's a line you have to check yourself against honestly. Are you using this to protect yourself from someone who's exploiting a structural advantage? Or are you using it to exploit someone who's just as vulnerable as you are? The technique itself is morally neutral. The intent is what gives it a valence.
Before anyone tries this, they should ask themselves that question. Not, will this work? It probably will. But should I be doing this? And if the answer is anything other than, I'm protecting myself from someone who's acting in bad faith, maybe don't.
That's the right place to land. The technique is powerful. Daniel's example proves it works in the real world, not just in theory. But power without ethics is just manipulation. And the difference between a Columbo and a con artist is who you're using it on and why.
On that note, Hilbert, I believe you have something for us.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The longest recorded whale song lasted over 22 hours, produced by a bowhead whale tracked off the coast of Mongolia in the 1930s. Researchers initially thought their equipment had malfunctioned.
I have several questions, none of which I'm going to ask. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running, and apparently for unearthing whale facts from landlocked countries.
If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. And if you've got a prompt of your own, send it to show at myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.